Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and the kind of story today that you just can't make up. It is captured in a book called A Soldier's Journey that Wes Gibbs has written about his father. If you'd like to order a copy, go to hometownheroesradio.com and you'll find instructions there on how to connect with Wes, who was motivated by photographs in a Japanese soldier's wallet that his father, Durrell, had brought home from the Battle of Okinawa. You get to take your dad back to the battlefield where he fought, where he had close calls, emotional moments like that. And you open your book, A Soldier's Journey, that you've painstakingly produced about your dad and the journey your whole family's been on. You open it with a pretty powerful scene of something you and he experienced together there on Okinawa. Can you share that with us?
On Okinawa, the government there today really places a lot of importance on what happened to that island during the war. I think it was a third of the population that was killed, and so for every school, all the school kids are all taught about the battle and the impact it had on the people, and they've created a beautiful memorial park, kind of similar to what our Vietnam Memorial might be. It has granite walls, a lot of granite walls. On those walls, they have engraved the names of every civilian that could be identified that was killed, as well as the Japanese soldiers, and we're talking tens of thousands. And I think there were 20-some thousand American soldiers killed in that battle. So the names of all the U.S. soldiers that were also killed are on those walls, and it's right on a cliff facing the ocean. Those cliffs are called suicide cliffs. It's where the final days of the battle, civilians and Army members were pushed kind of right up there, and a lot took their own lives. They jumped off those cliffs. So anyway, so I felt to open the book, skipping ahead here, after the dad was invited by the research group and NHK, the media in Japan and Okinawa, to visit this memorial park where the name of the soldier was engraved on the wall. And this is the actual soldier that had creeped up to their foxhole. And so we were arriving at the park that day. It was a beautiful morning. There was just a light mist of rain, and with that rain was kind of some mist and fog, and it was warm. It was a perfect setting for what we were doing. We entered the park, and the flowers are all in bloom at that time of the year, and so we were having a little memorial service, I guess you would call it, at that place, the place on the wall where that soldier's name was engraved. And I think Dad was nervous about, it was the first time we were really going to be exposed to the media, you know, after finding the name of the soldier. And later on that day, there was to be a press conference about this U.S. soldier that had come back to the island. And he was a little nervous. There's a lot of people who would not be able to understand why this U.S. soldier was recognizing an enemy soldier, a Japanese soldier. But it's hard for them to understand that unless they knew the full story. But at any rate, that morning was just a beautiful setting as we walked down through those stones, and that's how I chose to start the book.
Yeah, and I didn't mean to skip over anything because, again, you said you had no expectation. This was a needle in a haystack to find that specific soldier who had been the owner of that wallet. What were the developments that led to that discovery?
Well, our first days there, the very first day, the morning we woke up, Alex Kishaba served as a guide, and he wanted to take us to see some parts of the island where the fighting had been, and part of what the U.S. soldiers had to do was to, there were a lot of caves on the island. In fact, the Japanese strategy was to have, you know, their forces sheltered until after the bombardment, and then wait until after the landing, and then come out. So it was difficult to manage those caves. The civilians that were left tried to take shelter there, and so there was a lot of death that happened in those caves as the U.S. soldiers blew those caves up and used flamethrowers. And our first morning, they actually took Dad. He wanted to take Dad down this cave. It's well known. It's called the Cave of the Virgins.
This Alex, one of the stories he told, his mother was one of they'd go into these caves for some kind of protection. There was a bunch of sick Japanese soldiers and that down there, And his mother was a little girl, 12 years old or something like that. And it was her job to go down to the river and carry water up. And so she was kind of at the mouth of this cave. And they was going to blow this cave. I mean, that's hard, but that's a war. And she was by the mouth of this cave, and these soldiers come along, the U.S. soldiers. We come along. I didn't come along, but the U.S. soldiers come along, and they had to do something. They was going to blow that cave. Well, she ran off, and in the process, she wound up getting shot in the leg. Now, this Alex that Wes was mentioned, that was his mother. That little girl was his mother.
But if she hadn't run off, she would have been killed. He would have never been born. He wouldn't have been there to help you all along this process. And this Cave of the Virgins, you were starting to tell me, pretty memorable place.
Yeah, it was the first place we visited, and that's where he told us that story. And for the first time, I think in the excitement of getting us back and the excitement of wanting to see the battlefields and being there with Dad, it never really struck me how it might affect him. You know, I never thought of that too much. And we went down in that cave, and it's still blackened, and, you know, and that's what it's meant for. They take school children, they want people to know what happened. And so we got down there, and Dad kind of, well, it was really tough.
I didn't go very far. It brought things back too quick, too fast. And so I turned and went. I told him I was going back up. And
it was just too painful for you to contemplate.
Yeah, all of a sudden it was right there to me. And I had managed to kind of bury it for quite a few years. So I went back up, and then Wes can tell you kind of how it was.
Well, and I think it's really valuable and important that you two are sharing this with us, because there's so many families that never had this opportunity that maybe thought about it. And there's so many families where the World War II veteran is no longer here and didn't talk about it, buried it, like you said. So by your telling your story, you're filling in a lot of blanks for a lot of other people too. And filling in blanks is kind of what this was all about. This has been a journey of discovery that if you never started, there's a lot you wouldn't understand now, Wes. What happened from there?
Well, I would have to say, I was kind of devastated at that point. I just got thinking, what in the world have I done? But I could see now, and began to see then, that it was probably good. You know, it was a good thing. We got through with that. And, you know, like I say, that night I really had some second thoughts about what I had done. But we went on that day, and we discovered some other sites. And I think it was a way for Dad to face that. And we went on and had a good day. We had a book, the 96th Infantry Division book, with a lot of wartime photos. There were photographers embedded, Signal Corps photographers embedded with the division, and a lot of military, marine divisions, you know, a lot of pictures. And so the places where Dad had served, I had actual battlefield pictures. And so I was really interested to see if our guides could take us and we could locate those sites. So we were able to do that. Later on that day, Alex, once we got the Cave of the Virgins out of the way, he had set up a meeting with some local photographers and a newspaper, local newspaper publishers. And so later that day, we met with them, and they were just actually excited about our trip. Part of our trip, Alex had succeeded in, I had sent him a few days earlier the names, and one wonderful photograph of a soldier with a really serene look on his face, had his name on the back, and it was a soldier from Okinawa. It was not the soldier who owned the wallet, but this had his name and an address in Okinawa. And so we wanted to get that address out. The media met with us, and boy, the next morning the reasons for our trip and the pictures of the photographs, and then this one particular photograph that had the Okinawa address on it, were all in all the local media. That actually was a great kickstart to helping us to eventually identify the soldier who owned the wallet, as well as that soldier from Okinawa that was in that picture, who is also apparently a friend of the sergeant who had owned that wallet.
So that got the word out that that this is happening, that you're looking for the owner. Were you thinking yet, hey, this might actually happen, or were you still kind of cooling your jets on that?
Well, I would say after we had that meeting with the newspapers and all that, we were both genuinely excited about that. And maybe even to the point where the battlefield excursions were maybe a little secondary. Although those were important. we began to really get excited about what was happening on that regard. You know, in the next several days, the two former Marines who guided us, we succeeded in, you know, visiting actually the battlefield where Dad was in the foxhole, where he got the wallet and the Japanese soldier was killed. We visited that hill. We had pictures, and we actually stood on the location, you know, right where those things took place. That was exciting to me, and I think it was meaningful to Dad to be on those sites.
What was that like? To be back in that very spot where in a foxhole 66 years earlier, you had had that intense experience.
Well, the main thing was the island was so devastated, so all the vegetation was shattered. There was so much stuff on the ground, and here we was all these years later. I couldn't believe how it had been built up and how green everything was. That's where that lion, what do you call him?
The Tomari lion, which has been there for centuries.
Yeah, and here shows part of our unit crouched around that lion, and you can see all the bright white spots on the lion where bullets had hit that lion, and it just, a little chip had come off. You could just count them, and all these guys crouched down there. Here we was looking at that lion, and it just amazed me how Okinawa had changed in those years.
Yeah, this ancient sculpture, which had been cover for American soldiers against the Japanese, was now a tourist attraction once again. What about the quest, though, Wes? What were the developments that came next?
Sometime in that 2 or 3 day period, Alex called us at the hotel and very excited and said there was an item in the wallet, and I haven't discussed that before now. There were the photographs, but maybe the most interesting item in there was a little white envelope that was sealed. And on the front of that envelope, some really fine writing. I don't know how the name for Japanese writing, but Japanese characters, you know, vertical line of those, a couple lines, and then a seal, like someone's personal seal in wax. That actually turned out to be an envelope that belonged to the owner of the wallet, and it contained strands of his hair, pieces of his hair, short clippings actually, along with a fingernail clipping. But off the cover of that little envelope was his name and his unit number. So it was almost like what we'd have a dog tag. It was part of a religious belief for the Japanese soldiers. We found out later that if the contents of that envelope were able to get back to his home, even though he never did, that it would allow his spirit to return home. And so this research group was pretty excited. They had known about that practice, but never really had seen one of these envelopes. It never survived. You know, all those soldiers probably carried them, but they all just disappeared with the soldiers into the island. So they were excited to tell us they had ID'd him. His name was indeed engraved on the wall at the memorial, and they were now researching in Japan to see if they could locate his family. So the morning of about the fourth day, when we went and held the little memorial service, we were at his name. And later that day, Dad was interviewed by Stars and Stripes magazine and NHK, and there was an American photographer along. Later that day, they contacted us with the exciting news that they had located in Japan this soldier's home and discovered that he had a 2-year-old daughter at the time he was killed, and that she was still alive. That was the night before we were to leave, actually, for Okinawa, and of course that became just the most exciting news that we could imagine, and that they were in the midst of trying to contact her. And so Dad's intention at that point was to leave the wallet with the research group for them to give her the wallet back. And, you know, it was hard to leave Okinawa. The weather was perfect the whole time, and these developments, it was just the most exciting thing you can imagine, the way it turned out and how we felt that we were divinely led every step of the way. And it wasn't so much our doing. The doors were opened, you know, just as we needed them. That morning, as we were just getting ready to board the plane to leave for the U.S., Dad looked at me and he said, "Wes, I want to be the one to give her that wallet." So we had left it. We were boarding the plane. You know, I would have to say it was a little deja vu. When he said initially that he wanted to return the wallet, I thought, oh man, how are we going to do that? And here it had happened. And as we got on the plane, I don't think I'd learned my lesson. I thought to myself again, how in the world are we going to get to Japan and meet this soldier's daughter? Or will she even want to meet with us? But that started a whole another part of this journey.
And somebody knew exactly how it was all going to come about. But Daryl, I want to ask you, because you'd had this wallet for 66 years since you picked it up off the side of that foxhole. You knew it belonged to the soldier that had lost that hand-to-hand combat struggle with you in that foxhole, but you didn't know his name. When they were able to go through the contents of that wallet and find his name and put a name to that face you'd seen and that wallet you'd had, was that meaningful to you?
Well, sure, and it was meaningful for them, too, because, see, we was boarding the plane. I left the wallet hoping they could find. Yeah. Well, these develops happened as we was boarding the plane.
What changed for you that made you want to do it?
Well, I don't know. I do not know. I guess I just wanted to meet her. I wasn't realizing what that might entail. She might have been really bitter. When they found her, they told her the story that they had the wallet. On top of what I said, this research group, they sent the wallet back. They wanted me to come and give it to her. They wanted to see that happen.
And there are a lot of things that can, a lot of hurdles that need to be cleared. You've got a language barrier. You're going through intermediaries. You don't really know how she feels. It's a sensitive situation. But before we go any further, maybe I should have you mention the name of that Japanese soldier, because I'm sure it's a name you haven't forgotten since you finally were made aware of it.
Sergeant Kijiro Hocho.
Well, I guess, Daryl, it kind of sounds like every time you see the impossible become possible, you start to think more impossible things are possible.
Right. And, you know, that's when you look at life in general, that happens all the time. It just makes a difference in our lives.
Little did Daryl and Wes Gibbs know how many lives would be touched by the journey they were on, but we're going to hear about the culmination of their quest when we come back. Head over to hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes page on Facebook for photos and a video with Wes and Daryl, and Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,500 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.